We've had a lot of conversation about top down and bottom up, and it strikes me that if some people are in darkness and hidden, you two who are talking, come on forward. we want to be able to see everybody, because this is supposed to be a conversation, not just heavy discussion. Okay, well, what we're going to do is we'll have one question within the panel, and I'm going to ask each of the groups to ask another group a question about their presentations, because one of the things we have to do at the end is glue these three parallel sessions that are happening at the same time, and they're not going to have a chance to ask each other questions. So you have one chance to ask one question now, and then I'm going to open it up to the floor, but then you can ask more questions if you want to. So has anybody got a question?
Yes, can I?
Elena.
Yes, of course. I mean, because this is something important which has emerged not only through our presentation now, but it was also there in this room in the previous cluster. There is, of course, a political issue. There's some complexity in dealing with political matters around who is in charge of making suggestions, taking responsibility, who's accountable for transformations in this complex scenario. So, in this very wide framework, I would like to ask a small question. I would like to ask Marco about the participatory process you described about Katrina aftermath, this interaction between experts and people, say, affected by the toxic floods. Yeah, whether that worked, some process, some results, some hope, some example. You know.
Should I?
Yes, okay. Please.
So,
unless you want to dub Will in. I mean, it's a...
No, I think
I said Marco, but of course.
Okay.
Any...
Well, so, as you know, well, you, of course, this is the main point. Did it work or not? No. Well, in a way, it's also, I don't know, first of all, my first reaction would be to think about who's going to evaluate if something worked or not. No, because this is, I mean, for me, just the fact that, you know, grassroots organizations were sitting together with experts and trying to look at the situation together. And so, in a way, it was not a one-way process, you know, expert transmitting, you know, knowledge to these people, but actually it was the people telling them, you know, how they have experienced bodily the toxic contamination in those areas. But there is a book edited by Robert Bullard and other people, and which is precisely on the aftermath of Katrina. And according to them, those labs were actually kind of, you know, successful in a way, because they were able to affect somehow the decision of the EPA to, you know, to proceed in a certain way about reclamation after Katrina. So this would be my first answer.
Because I'm thinking of so many not working participatory
sure.
processes. So
I also have a question, can I?
Yes.
So my question is for your group.
It's a private conversation.
Yes, it's a conversation. We can just grab a cup of coffee. No, so my question is about the way in which you are framing nature within the city. Because I really, of course, I think it's a very powerful tool, and I really like your approach of going there. You know, it's precisely what I like to do. So, but on the other side, while you were showing the slides, I was a bit, I would say, surprised that the slides about nature were, you know, there were animals, I think a fox or
just
some,
outside here. Yeah. The fox has been photographed.
No, no, sure. But I was wondering, so are you, don't you think that maybe this is also reproducing a bit some kind of dichotomy? Because for me, thinking about nature in the city, I would say that the concrete is nature. You know, the cars are nature. The flux of energy, you know, the veins of our city full of water, oil, gas, is nature. I am not saying that fox, so it's not nature, no, but I am just saying, do you believe that there, I mean, you might reproduce somehow some dichotomy in this? I mean, are you? What is your opinion about my observation?
I don't know. I mean, I can have an answer, but I don't know whether Ezra wants to answer as well. I can tell you that we've been working on the dichotomy. Sure, this was not an attempt to overcome it. When we started, I started saying that there are ecosystems and social systems insisting on the same spaces. You could have argued, well, why do we have to separate them, right? Aren't we part of the ecosystem? So I should just define myself this way, yeah? Whereas I would have liked to keep the thing separated as a tool, as a working tool, as a provisional tool, in order to make some difference when, for example, we're going to go there and see an industrial area, as you I've seen from Ella's zooming in, there's no one single piece of grass there. So it's different. The Tiergarten and the Lichtenberg site are both natural. They are ecosystems and social systems. Okay, but they are different. So we cannot just put everything together. So in this case, letting the interference between two elements appear. Therefore, we need that dichotomy. But this is a working tool. I agree with you. It's a working tool.
Bill, did you want to comment? Because you had the fox, I think.
I would like to agree that we can't keep on going with greenwashing in cities. So for sure, the poison and the dust, the sound, it's all part of the nature. It's not longer this kind of nice image of the green. So if we see somewhere green, that's just like a surface. I don't believe in this kind of narrative that we still believe in having nature in the cities in a kind of wider sense. So it's really like all the ingredients, including the poison, and is part of the nature, and that makes it so interesting because all people have experienced that over years. So they already know, they have it in their cultural memory, that this is a new nature, that they are part of creating it.
And yeah, it's a great, you know what's funny is that Ellen and I are agreeing almost 100% here, which is so rare.
Okay, it's but, not but true. We are playing.
Yeah, but no, it is. And it's one of the reasons that we're here, right, is to find agreement and disagreement. And this idea of tools for thinking about human transformation of the planet, this sort of thing. And the idea of, so nature can be a unity. No problem, right? Everything's natural. The laws of physics apply to everything. There's simply nothing in the universe that's not part of that nature. What use is that? So as a tool, we can use this dichotomy of thinking about what is the human, what is the thing that distinguishes what we're doing from the thing that is being done to, in a sense, putting that dichotomy out there as a tool. I would guess there are probably 120, 150 different nature definitions out here that probably will change during this week. So I don't think it's like there has to be any fixed view of the dichotomy, what it means. But I think the use of that is a strong tool.
And the use is always anthropogenic in your idea?
What's that?
And use is a word that means people are using, rather than, say, the crow that uses the lid to snowboard down the roof in that very
terrific... Yeah, you'd have to add the human use.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you have any questions for the other groups, Adrian and Nabil?
I would have a question to the first group. Like, maybe you can explain a little further what nature are your new alliances you were talking about. We have some of those, like the UNO World Heritage is this kind of new alliances, which is like above nations, above borders. But who will get into power? And what's your idea of this empowerment? Let's say, if on the other hand, we could think about a grassroots movement, which maybe you were addressing more with your image of the Titanic. So what's your idea of empowerment towards these new alliances?
I think the first thing is it's an impossible question to answer in general. I would only ever have an answer to that depending on specific cases of struggle or of different constituencies that are involved in struggle. Maybe another response would be to say that I think like the metaphor bottom-up and top-down is extremely dangerous. And it's something that I never use and try to avoid strenuously. I think there's this idea somehow that the bottom-up is good, you know, the top-down is bad, or somehow the top-down is about domination and coercion, or that power moves from the top-down, and that somehow bottom-up movements are emancipatory. But we know that that's... History has countless examples to show that. Actually, it's far more complicated than that. liberalism. I mean, the invention of the idea of the bottom up, the first kind of theoretical formulation of the bottom up is the idea of price. Yeah. So the market, in a way, is the first kind of philosophical formulation of the bottom up. And let's say like the naturalization of the idea of the bottom up, and then is a kind of naturalization of the market. And I get very nervous as a kind of urban designer, as an architect as well, when I see images of slums and favelas as kind of examples of adaptation, because in fact here we have a kind of canonical example of obscuring what is actually fundamentally a political question around the withdrawal of the state and the withdrawal of state power, and its kind of naturalization in terms of some kind of like creative human adaptation. I think what's far more important is in fact to look more precisely at these situations, to understand their history, their political histories in more detail, so that we don't start making, I think, very, very dangerous conflations between quite different things.
There's one quick question about the bottom-up, Adrian, that I wanted to address to you, and that is the map that you were projecting was on the Mercator projection, which puts 66% of the Earth in the Northern Hemisphere. And I know you come from the Southern Hemisphere and would appreciate that difference, but the Southern deserts have had a much harder time getting recorded. There is good stuff now, and it'd be a shame if your map squashed that knowledge into smaller spaces. There's a bottom-up for you.
Well, I mean...
Can I also add a remark on this? Because... Oh, sorry.
I mean, I was just going to say, in response to that, that's actually a kind of... That project's a work in progress, working with the people who are putting together these visualizations, actually, and that's a kind of draft version of it. So, in fact, the biggest problem was coordinating the different projections for the visualizations and kind of compositing them together. But,
If I could just sort of briefly speak about what the question on alliances, it's at the same time, I think the way we sort of try to formulate the problem is to also see, understand the alliances also as modes of violence, where it's difficult to separate the causalities of whether it's environmental or sort of human sort of causalities. And it's precisely working from within that's complexity, but still trying to understand how evidence can sort of work as a sort of productive negative kind of space in order to think about how we can still assign responsibility. In this sense, the presentation after us from Marco and Will was just really amazing, because it just sort of in a lot of ways, it sort of connected the way I was sort of looking at cyclones, right? But then kind of bringing it to the historical and the sort of meteorological conditions, but at the same time looking at somewhere like New Orleans, which might be a very different place than the frontiers of Bangladesh, but where those kind of political sort of problems are articulated in certain ways in quite dramatic way in Bangladesh in the early 70s, but then equally dramatic but sort of less sort of mediatized in the sense of what happened in New Orleans. So it's not really a question, but I just wanted to perhaps it was really obvious to everybody, but I think it's important to sort of to bring that to the table.
It's a question of power again, as we said before. I mean, surely you know the IPCC working group, the second, is the one which is developing huge documents, and which the latest one has been released recently, has got resilience and adaptation as keywords, right? So we have an awful lot of power in terms of resources, have manpower and researchers from whatever discipline, very interdisciplinary endeavors, which have been spent in order to produce those two words, which make us all a bit uneasy, right? And then say, what's increased? Have you read those reports? Surely you have. Let's increase the sanitation conditions in where people do live. So instead of, shall we erase the favelas, or rather bring water there and build some toilets? And the answer is, let's bring some water. So in fact, we had some interrogation marks around there. Is it engineered nature? So sure, that was not an answer. This is, let's be aware that an enormous percentage of the efforts publicly invested at the highest political level onto dealing with these topics we are today kind of discussing friendly about, is going in that direction. So the question of the power and also the whether they were effective or not, your participatory assembly in New Orleans, makes a difference.
Sure.
I think speaking of participatory, we have a lot more people sitting here than sitting here, and we want to hear from you. And I, before some of you came in, I said there is no seating behind the rail because I can't see you. The light is on this part, so please come forward and join the rest. And I'm looking for questions, and when people ask a question, could you just say your name and where you're from so we start to get to know each other? We're going to be together for a long time. Do I have a question from the floor? Please move. Come on. Yes, thank you.
Check. Hi.
Unusual name.
Check. I'm from the Czech. I'm from British Petroleum Press. No. My name's...
Welcome.
Okay, good. So, I'm sorry that this is going to seem obnoxious to everybody, but I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to come down here. Because we already talked about heterarchy, and we already talked about needing to think and act in different ways, right? And I think we're all here thinking and acting in different ways, but maybe not so much acting in different ways. And what I want to propose is a very quick exercise. I'm sorry, it's not a question.
Would
I
have like
extreme
have
respect
it's,
for
it,
all of
it
you.
It needs no, to be a quick exercise, because I'm
quick.
A bossy moderator.
It takes 3 minutes. It's about the same time as it takes to ask a question and get a response. So I'm going to ask everyone to stand up, please. Please stand up.
We too.
Fantastic.
We will tell you.
Sasha is going to be my partner. Okay, so now what I'm going to ask you to do is get a partner, but not the person next to you, because you know them very well, probably the person behind you. And just touch that person. And you guys just get your partner. Everyone touch each other.
One big loving family.
It always makes a lot of laughter. So it's also about our relationships to each other and how our incapacity to just relate to other humans is also quite devastated by corporate power and other things. So here is a little exercise we do called the sponge. It's very nice. And now what we're going to do, one of your partners who you're touching.
You should only have one partner there. Just
or it's not
going
to work.
You're dividing us.
It's crazy,
sexy,
okay,
but... Sorry. Okay, now all we're going to do is very simple, right? We're just going to pretend that my friend, or she's going to do it for me, that I am a sponge, and she's going to get all the bad seeping oil and coal out of my body. That's it. Seriously, I know it's hard. It's hard.
Do me or I'll do
really.
You. Or I'll do you.
Okay.
It's just about
it's more than 3 minutes
having contact.
Anyway.
Does that feel better?
With other humans.
Perfect.
Oh, yeah. How's your research about
that? Any other one?
Exactly.
See how difficult. Do you see how difficult it is to just have contact with another human? And how easy and nice it can be as
it's
well.
It's a question of setting. If we were in a gym, yeah, and
thank
then
you.
With the jacket,
and then
and
do it the other way.
Now
so
she's
now
a...
she's the sponge.
We do theater already. Man.
That's all I wanted to do. That's all I wanted to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
While the people at the back are standing, come and sit down. I asked for performance and we get it, don't we? This is great. Next question.
Next event.
Next exercise.
Next exercise, okay.
That's a hard one to follow.
It's a very hard act to follow, actually. Isn't that interesting? I mean, the fact that it's a hard act to follow. I did have one question that I'm not sure which of you is going to take on, but I was thinking that if we'd been having this panel 30 or 50 years ago, how much less we would have seen of the aerial perspective. I'm actually wearing the aerial perspective today. This is a work of art by someone from Utopia in Central Australia. That's the name of the mission station. I don't think it's the original name the Aboriginal people called the area. But that is the view from the air as understood by Aboriginal people. But the view of the air, from the air is, the aeriality, as Bill Fox calls it, is quite a filter. And maybe the filtering team might want to take that. Will, do you want to...
Yeah, well, look, I think the iconic one, of course, is the one we've seen several times, which is really from deep air, if you like it, up in space, looking back at planet Earth. And I think that had as much effect or more effect than any of the science that we did in these big global change programs to convince people that the Earth was one system. But I think the thing that really struck me from Earl's presentation is you can really understand a lot by looking at patterns, and you can't get the patterns so easily when you're immersed in it, like in this very complex landscape that he was showing. By taking that view, it gives you another perspective, and it gives you some idea of connectivity and spatial patterning, and that's really important to understand how a system operates. So I think it's actually been a very big factor in pushing along our understanding.
But you don't actually need to see from the air to have a bird's eye view, because that's what this suggests, that this is not done from an aeroplane. This was done from a knowledge of the ground. So what we have now is the privilege of the aeroplane over the knowledge from the ground. And maybe this is another answer to the bottom up. So have I finally got a question from the floor now? Well, I've filled in. Come on. There must be. Yes, thank you. She's coming with my microphone, and there's another one there. Good. We're starting to gather them. If a flock of hands go up, I'll collect more than one question. So, come on.
Hi, my name is Megan. I'm a PhD student in the UK at the moment. You mentioned discomfort with the words adaptation and resilience, and I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit more on that, particularly concerning climate adaptation.
Okay. Sorry, I guess that's a...
Who mentioned it?
Is there a question for
both of us,
specifically me? Or?
Yes,
right. Okay, so there are at least two answers. One is the thing that I thought, what I think, and the other is what is embedded in most of the documents, the official documents about these words. So I personally strongly believe in the concept of resilience. Resilience is a form of negotiations, in my perception. So we have a resilience processes during the production of the seminar, for example. Each of us had a very precise issue at the beginning. Eventually, without surrendering too much to our expertise or ideas, we ended up doing one single presentation. So resilience is a way of letting two different perspectives or many different perspectives come together without retroacting onto the nature of each of them, transforming it, but finding superposition, negotiations, flexible boundaries between each other. The way this word is being declined, but you surely can correct me for it, because you know these documents much better than me, and maybe you also know the reason why such words were selected in the first place, is that there's not much we can do about the climate change. The thing is already there. We are already living in such a planet, which is in a very unfortunate condition, especially somewhere, first, second, third class tickets in the planet. Yeah. Therefore, the better we can do is not regenerate our knowledge, is not put bottom upside down our heads, our mind, our performing strategies during conferences. Rather, we make a resilience. So we make the best of it. We try to resist. So we create protection areas around the polluted sites so that we don't really go too close to them. We build up argents around the potential flooding rivers. So such a very good word. I mean, everybody is acquainted here with the word of George Lakoff about framing. So the way you name problems counts a lot. So what does resilience mean? Maybe it's an extra crucial word for our glossary. Resilience is a very good term, in my perspective. It's a very democratic, potentially, attitude that we could assume towards things, but it's been completely sidetracked, misinterpreted and misfilled with meanings, which now means let's cope with what's already existing and let's make the most of it. Instead of taking our clothes off and say we have to start again, we have to regenerate with a very, very big quantum leap in terms of capacity of producing technology and answers to the problems. But this is a very personal view, right? So please integrate it.
I'm going to take the three questions that are sitting out here at the moment. You first, and then you can pass the microphone to in the same row, and in between you can go. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Gustavo Valdivia, a PhD student in anthropology at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. I was thinking something that was said at the end of the presentations about power and representation, and I was thinking if wouldn't it be interesting also to start thinking how power is also permeating the concepts we use for example, this discussion, for example, climate. how much power is involved in there in this idea that the average weather from the last 30 years, I mean, it's also using this average, using this, or assuming that this stable climate, like when I used to, I mean, what challenges me when I'm trying to think about this is, for example, the idea of the tropics, that it's also such a colonial concept, and how it's completely embedded in like all climate science. If you don't have the tropics, you don't have to explain that. But the tropics is an idea that is so charged of, I mean, this idea that this is a deadly zone and that something cannot be understood. And I mean, I'm thinking about how also these concepts, there's more discussion to be done in not only how we map the world, but also how the words we use to represent the phenomena in that we are trying to deal. And now they are trying to, you know, we are assuming there is a global problem, but I mean, probably we need to also discuss the relationship between climate science and power and how we conceptualize this the nature and phenomena.
Thank you. And over here?
You have used this image of Titanic and we see the iceberg, but on the way we don't make full machinery stop, which could be this slowing down you mentioned yesterday, and just on a lower level try to rebuild. It seems like we go full power into the iceberg, and the question is, if we're not going to make it, what is the plan to smooth maybe a little bit music, you know, till the end? And
and you haven't told us your name and where you're
Misha
from.
Misha Vetere, I'm poet and painter in Berlin.
Thank you. And the third question?
Hi, I'm Maya Kovska. I'm an independent scholar based in New Delhi and Beijing, and a political culture theorist. And my question is actually more about methodology and the sort of approaches that we use for coming at these questions. It's wonderful that we have such an interdisciplinary group that can share such vast ranges of empirical knowledge. But one of the hard parts about interdisciplinarity is that when we come to the table, we don't all mean the same things when we say the same words. So I heard the word case thrown out a lot, hypothesis, and some other questions. And what would be really wonderful to hear is from each of the groupings, or even within the groupings, if we could just step back to try to create more of a common language and talk about what counts as a case, what counts as a hypothesis, how do we know if we're not, how do we know when we're wrong, what kind of procedures for making truth claims are we using here? Because these are the places where the divides, especially between STEM and the human sciences, really lead to conversation gaps or inabilities to talk to each other. So maybe everybody could just say a little bit about their own epistemological underpinnings that would help the group as a whole to see that we mean different things when we say these words like case and hypothesis, or that we're trying to pursue certain kinds of findings or draw certain kinds of conclusions, so that we can evaluate those things better. Thanks.
So we have three different questions about words. We have a question of the colonization of the language of cartography, the tropics. We have a question about slowing things down so we can hear. And we have what are our starting points in different common words that might mean different things for different people. Do we have comments from within the panel? Is there anybody who wants to talk to all three of those things? Because you can go first.
And if, too much.
Okay, good on you,
first,
Adrian.
I can at least talk to the first and third one. I think the...
You'll do it slowly, so you answer the second one as well.
I'm going to do it slowly while everyone else formulates an answer. I think one thing that we can get a lot better at doing is paying attention to the scale at which we pose problems and the kind of the scale of, at which we use language. Yeah, because I think in abstractions that, let's say, like cover over multiple things, there's always the kind of potential of a kind of like a violence or an erasure. So somehow, and this is something that I kind of developed in my own work a lot, which is to think about the kind of calibration, let's say, between epistemology, between language, between different forms of technical representation, and the phenomena these things are trying to capture. And I think that's something that's really fundamental in science, especially in climate science. There's a lot of time spent getting those calibrations right. But I think that's just as true of actually the way we speak and the kinds of words that we use. And so I think that's the first thing that I would say. I think in terms of questions of method, I'll probably give a really insufficient answer here, but I think at least in the work that Nabil and I have done with the center, there's always an idea that we start off with a problem. And I think for me, in a way, my definition of scale is as a problematic in some way, and that the problem is something that is not like only a human projection. In fact, nature experiences problems. I think Wolfgang had a kind of example yesterday of the beginning of photosynthesis on the Earth and how this kind of poses a problem to the Earth system. And I think that problems exert a kind of force on us. You know, they kind of solicit us. They're kind of actors in a certain sense. And so starting with a problem, I think, does something quite unique. Rather than maybe start with a kind of like disciplinary frame, you actually allow the problem or try to unpack the problem and, in fact, then track where the problem leads. And I think that's a different way of starting to think about the organization of knowledge. I mean, as a kind of thought experiment, you could imagine universities that were not or campuses that were not organized around, let's say, disciplines, but around specific problems. And how would that kind of cut transversally across different forms of knowledge production? And I guess, you know, what we're doing here is actually hopefully an example of that.
Who wants to go next? Does there someone want to? Will.
Yeah, I'll make a comment about the last one about methods. That was a really, really good question. And coming from the physical sciences, one of the big mistakes that my area of science often made was to say, all right, we got a problem, and then realize halfway through that they needed some social science expertise and then try to go capture a tame social scientist and say, here, you do this, which was completely wrong way around. I think it actually goes even deeper a bit than language, and that is, I think at the very beginning, the problem has to be defined together. And that by nature, I guess, requires you to get into the language issue. But a lot of people like to skate over that, but my experience has been you have to take time to get to know each other and to understand how these words, how these concepts are used, because they're quite different in the physical sciences from other areas. And you have to actually define the problem together right from the very beginning. And these are critical steps. So I think you've put your finger on a very important issue.
And it may not be a problem for some people. I mean, EBI, framing it as a problem suggests a problem, exactly, that we're going to fix it.
Yeah. It may not be a problem.
Okay, so I would like to say something, first of all, about the slowing down of the ship. Well, I think that the big issue here is, first of all, that it is easier today to think about the apocalypse, you know, something, you know, the complete destruction of the world as we know it, than to think about the end of capitalism, for instance. No? So I think that this is, you don't slow the machine because you don't think that there is, you know, a very famous prime minister said there is no alternative. So, I mean, if the issue is there is no alternative, you don't need to slow down the machine. Second, I would argue that the issue is that you think that you can make it. And actually, for the first class passengers, it was not, I mean, they were not completely crazy because many of them, 75%, made it. So probably they were not so crazy. And this is the second point. About the word and the power embedded in the word. Well, I would just say something that I think that this is precisely our job as humanities and social sciences scholars to, I would say, occupy the glossary of the Anthropocene. Because I think that we have two options here. One is to think that the Anthropocene is finally our revenge. The Anthropos is back. Here we are. Or maybe we could think that it's the other way around. It's that the nature is back again and we are lost. So I think that, you know, my slogan is actually occupy the Anthropocene and try to make sense of the world. And for make sense of the world, I believe, is to bring in the picture the issue of antagonism.
Because and you're using Occupy technically, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. And so I believe that this is, and speaking of the methodology, I think that I am very bad. You know that historians are probably the less methodological guys in the world. Which you could say that we tell stories, which is not very, you know, highly technological and methodological sophisticated. But I believe that there is a power in narratives. And probably I would say that the most important issue is here is the ability or the willingness to listen to. And if you need to build a common methodology, probably, you know, the basic skill, of course, must be very sophisticated, you know, Deleuzian methodologies or something very complicated that nobody understands, but we need to quote because it's very cool. Or maybe it's just, you know, the willingness to listen to other people. And I would say that for me it's a very basic skill. As an historian, I would say even as a human being.
I just wanted to address the question around the tropics and how that term has sort of has been appropriated. I mean, in a sense, that is sort of why, as soon as Marco and Will sort of came on stage, I saw this interaction between a sort of a historian and a sort of climate scientist sort of trying to understand the same problem in sort of different ways. I think it's precisely, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, climate or science should sort of try to understand sort of the sort of the potency of how that word has been sort of used, right? Tropics and sort of these ideas of the tropical. But I think this sort of brings us to the question that Maya raised about sort of the use of language. I don't know. I mean, I suppose this is what we're trying to do here in a very short time, right? To sort of see which terms can be contested and which terms can we agree on? Because it just takes time. I mean, we spent like 4 years at the center, sort of developing very closely, very intensely, a set of words and terms that we could sort of used to mobilize our research, but then towards the end of that process, if I can sort of speak briefly for the group, is that we start to see that it was also something that was getting quite closed, and so we started to think about how do we sort of translate, open that up again, and try to see how we can sort of move those ideas and those words or to make them more open, and I think that's sort of maybe a danger or sort of part of the process of sort of working really intensively on this point.
Can I add something?
I'd like to see if there's any more questions in the audience. So we've got one, two, three at the moment. So I think we keep the answers short because we've got more people out here.
It's methodological and both. I mean, we were invited at the very beginning to concentrate on case studies. Yeah, there's been a request which has been very clear, repeated in every communication. Why this? I keep on thinking, and these questions make me think that if we concentrate temporarily on a very bordered problem or example, we risk slightly less to misunderstand badly about the thing. So I see that the worst misunderstandings come out of large-scale descriptions. If I explain to you now my epistemology, and then I'm going to ask question, who has got anything from my description, I'm going to get as many as you are, different answers. Whereas if I try to get down to an example, and of course the city is not enough, because the city may mean so many different things. So one city, one district, three streets, there, the people living there, those faces. I'm not saying that there's no misunderstanding there. There's still need of a glossary, there's still need of power definitions, but we can try to reduce the complexity or the gravity of the problem. Yeah, and that in order to be able to rescale it up again.
Okay,
later.
We've got wind-up noises, so I'm going to add a fourth question to the set, the lady just there. So we've got one, two, three, four. And try and express your question or your statement quite briefly.
I'll start with
your name.
François Boucher from Colombia, artist, doing a PhD in artistic practice in the north of Sweden, if that means anything. it's a new thing, like the PhD in artistic practice. I was just having this thought that at the same time as geology is becoming politics, then light is shed on the anthropos as nature. At the same time, the studies on the rhesus monkeys, people who are studying the rhesus monkey, for example, and are finding solidarity between the rhesus monkeys are starting to talk about culture. I just wanted to bring that impression up. And then I was thinking of that algae that goes all the way from the other side of the world to the Amazon. And it made me think of that phrase of Terence McKenna, who in a trialogue with Rupert Sheldrake and Ralph Abraham said, the future of the internet is no internet at all, Gaia. We are co-expressing what was already there. So you're thinking about this non-local thing, algae that comes all the way from the other side of the earth, this entanglement, to speak in quantum terms. And then you go to what is happening to thought, to mind right now. I mean, people speak about singularity in these very limited parameters, the technological singularity, when singularity could mean, in a sense, non-local mind, non-local thinking. And that puts us in the old dimension of a thinking globe that sends algae, is that the plural? Algae. From the other side of the world to the Amazon in such a complex thing. I mean, we're discovering the most obvious thing, that we were always already in an intelligent, intricate system. It was obvious, it is obvious, it will always be obvious, but we seem to be rediscovering it today.
Okay, pass the microphone. And there's one over here. Somebody on this side had a question. Is there a microphone for this? Yep, go ahead, please.
My name is Chirag. If you didn't get that, I respond to Jacques Chirac. My question is going to be a little different from that one. It's also related to some, possibly all the other themes in the last day and a half. But being the last session, I think it's relevant. I think what I'm finding, in a sense, almost worrisome is the thing that we are not discussing, which would be the simplest possible solution to many of the problems that we have identified as being part of this Anthropocene era: reducing consumption. We've been tying ourselves into knots about how complex the system is, how changes in one part of the system could lead to feedbacks in other parts of the system. And I'm not even sure that reducing consumption enormously now will necessarily return the system to a stable equilibrium state. It might not happen. Maybe one of the wicked modelers here can shed some light on that. But reducing emissions, carbon emissions in particular, is the root cause of many of the issues here. It's consumption of fossil fuels which is the problem, and it can be solved simply by reducing consumption. Now, if you're not talking about it, it's either that we are not consciously aware that this is a solution, or we don't want to, but either way, we have to confront ourselves, because 20 years down the line, when we phenomenally fail in every other possible way to solve this problem, we'll have to remember back to today, 15th of November, when we decided that we were not going to choose that path, and we are trying to do anything else that's possible.
Thank you, Chirac, and thank you for the new word. Did everybody get wicked modelers? I quite like that one. The third question here, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Marisa. I'm from World Agroforestry Center. My question goes to Nabil. In your presentation, you put the picture of Papua. You say there is conflict, environmental conflict in Papua. But some people also say it's in Papua, the conflict started with the transfer of power from Dutch colonization to Indonesian government. And also the people said because of ethnic difference between the Papuan and other Indonesian. My question is, how far did you relate this conflict with these issues, such as the transfer of power and then the ethnic diversity? Thank you.
You forgot your name.
Marisa.
Marisa, thank you.
Stella Vesiana from the Federation of German Scientists and Artist Researcher. So my question would be, as we are in the climbing aspect of the Anthropocene, how can we relate it to other methodological approaches as in the European Framework Program? They are developing this RRI, Responsible Research and Innovation Program, where they're also addressing the societal challenges as the Anthropocene does, and where they're also trying to find process requirements and outputs. So in which way the term of responsibility is important relating to research policies? So again, the question, how can we think about participative governance in the field of the research and in this societal challenges?
I think we'll go and we'll get one response from each person, because we've got slightly less than 5 minutes left. That gives you 1 minute each. And you don't have to respond to all the questions. You can just pick out the one that helps you sum up the day. And I'll pick on you at the far end and we'll come back.
So I got a very easy question for the last answer for the last question. There will be on next Saturday, there will be exactly the discussion on participatory governance. So maybe we can't answer everything right now. That's the fun of the whole 9 days here.
Yeah, I'll echo that. We're not going to solve it by asking a bunch of people seated here what the answer is. And I think the classic one, right, is, you know, why don't we just consume less? I mean, why didn't? Yeah, good question. We could each one of us could ask that question and answer it in our own way. But nobody's ever found a way to get an entire world system to reduce its consumption. I've never heard of a way to do that. It's a great example of a wicked problem, though, and there is a wicked problem session. So that would be a place to discuss that, I think.
I mean, I think it's a great example of capitalism. I mean, for example, if you were to look at China at the moment, and there's something called the hukou reform, where they're giving residency permits to the floating population of something like 250 million people. The purpose of that reform is to stimulate domestic consumption markets, so to insulate the Chinese economy from fluctuations in currency prices overseas, right? That's a lot of effort going into increasing consumption. And, you know, it's like, sure, but it's a pipe dream, yeah? I mean, there's a very complicated, powerful political system in place to keep you consuming and to train you to consume and to make you want to consume more.
Yeah, go for it.
But No. If you want to
jump
about on
the hukou thing. The hukou system is the most unpopular, oppressive system to rural people who want to move to the city.
Yep.
That's the main reason I think they're getting rid of it, is because it's always been hard to maintain because people don't like it.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, people's access to social services is dependent on going back to the village. can I just add something? Because I need to respond to the person who's doing the art practice PhD in Sweden. I don't know how you got the idea that it was a kind of, I'm a hippie, or that was a kind of hippie presentation, but I misunderstood what I was trying to say. I think the idea of Gaia is despotic, and it's exactly what I was trying to say we should be moving away from. I don't think it's about planetary consciousness or that the fact that the Earth is sentient in any way. The whole point was that, in fact, certain relationships dominate over others, and not everything is connected. In fact, things are pulling apart, things are cut, things are divided, and I think that's extremely important.
You never get between an audience and its
beer. But I like the fact
beer.
That you mentioned Terence McKenna. I thought that was good.
Marco.
Okay, very briefly. First of all, responsibility and great societal challenges. First of all, I think that the big issue here is going to decide which are those big societal challenges, because maybe we are not talking about the same things. So I think that for me, what is really relevant here is the possibility to sit on the same table and not to just respond to the societal challenges that somebody else said they are big and needed answer. But I want to actually be part of the discussion, exactly. Which are. And then responsibility, sure, but towards whom? Because, I mean, I am very responsible towards the grassroots group that I am working with. But I may be look very responsible to somebody else. And you know, it's a chance that you have to take if you want to be really committed to something or someone. Reducing consumption is a very difficult topic for me. Generally, I am really bad in this answer because, I mean, on one hand, absolutely, I mean, I agree, and I am also very curious of the degrowth movement and theory and so on. On the other side, I am kind of old-fashioned guy, and I believe that you need, you know, systemic changes. And there is a wonderful book, the title is This Changes Everything. Yeah. And I mean, if we want to change everything, I am in. But if the issue is, to go on the supermarket and, you know, buy something, you know, biological, I mean, I do that. But I am not sure that it's what is needed. But I know that it's very personal and it's very old-fashioned. So I know all the critique and I take them.
Will.
Yeah, just a very quick further comment to President Chirac's question. And I think the question there is there some way without reducing consumption you can get emissions down? And of course, the proposal is you decouple consumption, economic growth, and so on from its environmental impact. So far, it's been an abysmal failure. There's been absolutely no evidence whatsoever over two decades of trying to get on top of the problem that works. So I think there are more and more people who are really questioning the capitalist economic system. It's the first time in my whole life I've actually seen, I think, serious questioning of that. And it's a result of the pressure it's putting on not only the climate, but the whole Earth system.
Right. Elena?
Yes, I might say something which is not addressing to any question in particular, I hope to many. And that is what we're going to do, right? We cannot expect any patriarchal answering from somewhere to somewhere else. Otherwise, we just fail the complete idea. I hope that if something is going to come out of this meshy week, is some procedure that each could reenact in his or her own environments, like seeds that have been thrown almost blindly. Okay, so some of them could just fail. I just don't produce anything at all, but in order to reproduce strategies of confrontation. And therefore, we have to select crucial words, for example, through those glossaries or methodologically speaking. I've been defined as an anthropologist. I'm just partially an anthropologist. I come from natural sciences. So I try to benefit of many methodological strategies that I learned during my several wandering years across the universities, for example. So this is something which doesn't make sense if I do it by myself, right? So it should be propagated. And so here, this is a sort of an engine that should go around, go further.
Thanks for your question. I guess what has been my sort of, this is related to the Papua question. The way that I've sort of contributed to that is sort of folding the political history with its sort of extractive history. That is to say, it's actually something that was the subject of one of the earlier exhibitions at a conference at the HKV called After Year Zero, and then the conference Geographies of Collaboration, which sort of looked at the birth of the non-alignment movement. And so what I'm sort of building on so, you know, the amazing work of sort of many historians and sort of political analysts around the question of the Papuan sovereignty. The way I sort of articulated it is by looking at the Bandung moment, which is sort of the time when sort of non-alignment sort of is promoting the idea that I think it's interesting that we were saying with Adrian that this, again, this non-alignment was sort of like playing with this idea of the line, right? To sort of place anti-colonial nationalism as sort of the forefront of a new way of sort of conceptualizing sort of geopolitics, right? But it was precisely in the Bandung moment, if you look at the final communique of the Bandung moment, where sort of the countries that were sort of supporting Indonesia, the host country, said that so there were sort of two statements made at the very end. One of the first one said that we side with the Palestinians in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and we side with the Indonesian state on the Papuan question. So that is to dispossess the rights of who are sort of the Papuans, which sort of formulated through the so-called Act of Free Choice, where the UN becomes completely a collaborator in the way then this occupation sort of is accepted in the international community. But the second point, which is sort of folds the environmental question back into that, has been sort of tracing what has been sort of underlying the current in some of those negotiations, which are not really sort of discussed in so much publicly, which was the sort of awareness of a lot of these political actors, which didn't include the Papuans, about sort of the minerals that were sort of flowing underneath that would
I think maybe
erupt.
You talk some more about this afterwards. That might be good. In the interest of participatory moments, we're going to have the final comment from the floor. And it's going to be very short.
Yes. Hi, my name is Hunter. I work with words and people and spaces, among other things. I was going to propose that we leave a sheet of paper on the stage with a pin, and then people could write down words that have come up throughout the day, and then it would serve as some sort of like archive of some sort of like map of everything that people have discussed. So if it's okay, I leave the paper with a pin.
Well, perhaps we put the paper on a board somewhere because we're not always in this room, but I think it's a great idea.
Okay, so maybe just outside at one of the circular tables.
Yes, one of the people in the team.
Just outside. There'll be a paper with a pin if anyone wants to write words.
And if you want to put a question mark next to the word, do that too.
You can also write questions.
So thank you very much for being a patient audience, and we're getting you to your beer 6 minutes late. I'm sorry about that.